From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We're confident that it is constitutional, and quite frankly, of the three courts that have rendered decisions on this question, two have ruled in our favor.
But one didn't. A Virginia federal judge rules requiring Americans to purchase health insurance is unconstitutional. We'll look at the decision and the judge's ties to a Republican consulting firm that fights health care reform. Then the Senate is set to pass President Obama's controversial tax deal with Republicans.
I recognize that folks on both sides of the political spectrum are unhappy with certain parts of the package, and I understand those concerns. I share some of them, but that's the nature of compromise.
We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David K. Johnston, former reporter for The New York Times, who talks about how the wealthiest Americans enrich themselves at government expense and stick you with the bill. Then it's the biggest strike— prison strike in American history. Thousands of prisoners in at least seven prisons across Georgia go on strike to protest poor living and working conditions. The prisoners use cell phones to coordinate the strike. We'll speak with the former chair of the Black Panther Party, Elaine Brown. She's a member of the newly formed Concern Coalition to Respect Prisoners' Rights. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is appearing in a London courtroom today, a week after his arrest on an international warrant to face sexual crime allegations in Sweden. Assange is seeking release on bail as he fights his extradition to Sweden amidst the international controversy over WikiLeaks' recent publication of secret U.S. diplomatic cables. The Justice Department's rumored to have impaneled a federal grand jury to indict Assange here for publishing the cables. Earlier today, Assange's mother, Christine Assange, spoke out after a brief conversation with her son.
He's being held in the basement of the prison, right in the middle of the prison, in solitary confinement. As a mother, I'm asking the world to stand up for my brave son.
An online petition by the website Avaaz in support of WikiLeaks has attracted over 600,000 signatures. Among the latest prominent backers to volunteer as guarantors for Assange's bail is the U.S. filmmaker Michael Moore, who says he's put up $20,000 for Assange's release. In a statement released today to Australian television, Julian Assange said, quote, "My convictions are unfaltering. I remain true to the ideals I've expressed. If anything, this process has increased my determination that they are true and correct." A federal judge in Virginia has struck down a cornerstone of President Obama's health care reform law as unconstitutional. On Monday, U.S. District Judge Henry Hudson ruled the government can't force Americans to purchase mandatory health insurance or face penalties. It's the first time a court has voided any piece of the health care law since its adoption earlier this year. The ruling came in a lawsuit filed by the state of Virginia, one of two dozen challenging the law in federal courts nationwide. But it's expected to have little impact because it does not impose an injunction freezing the law's implementation. Two other courts have also issued rulings favorable to the law in similar cases. The debate over the law is expected to end up before the Supreme Court. The judge in the Virginia case, Judge Hudson, is the part owner of Campaign Solutions, a Republican consulting firm that's worked to oppose health care reform. The firm's clients have included Sarah Palin and John McCain. Federal disclosures show Hudson has earned up to $108,000 from his holdings in the firm since 2003. We'll have more on health care reform and the ruling after headlines. The Senate's on the verge of approving President Obama's controversial tax deal with Republicans. On Monday, the Senate overwhelmingly voted 83-15 to end debate on the measure and bring it to a final vote. Under the deal, Obama agreed to extend the Bush-era tax cut for the wealthiest Americans and reduce the estate tax in return for a 13-month extension of jobless benefits and a handful of tax credits for low- and moderate-income Americans. According to The New York Times, at least a quarter of the tax savings under the deal will go to the wealthiest 1% of the population. The only group that'll see its taxes increase are the nation's lowest-paid workers. At the White House, President Obama called the deal a victory for the middle class.
It is a substantial victory for middle-class families across the country who would no longer have to worry about a massive tax hike come January 1st. It would offer hope to millions of Americans who have lost their jobs through no fault of their own by making sure that they won't suddenly find themselves out in the cold without the unemployment insurance benefits that they were counting on.
The measure will go to the House if the Senate approves it as expected today. House Democrats have voiced opposition to the deal and could seek to alter provisions reducing the estate tax. We'll have more on the tax deal vote later in the broadcast. The debate over tax cuts comes just as Wall Street's biggest firms are set to complete their most profitable two-year period in investment banking and trading on record. According to Bloomberg News, the firms Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Morgan Stanley generated $93.7 billion in the first 9 months of 2010, on pace to fall 10% short of last year's record, $127.8 billion. Collectively, the firms have taken in over $135 billion under the Wall Street bailout program and borrowed billions more from the Federal Reserve. The field of incoming Republican House committee chairs continues to draw controversy before the new Congress begins next month. The next chair of the House Financial Services Committee, Congressmember Spencer Baucus of Alabama, has been quoted saying lawmakers and regulators should serve Wall Street. Speaking to the Birmingham News, Baucus said, quote, "In Washington, the view is that the banks are to be regulated, and my view is that Washington and the regulators are there to serve the banks." Shortly before the midterm elections that propelled him into the committee chairmanship, Baucus urged a gathering of financial industry lobbyists to donate heavily to Republicans in response to the Democrats' overhaul of financial regulation. Three U.S. soldiers discharged under the law barring openly gay service members have filed a lawsuit against the federal government. On Monday, the soldiers asked a U.S. district court in San Francisco to grant them reinstatement in the military and declare the Don't Ask, Don't Tell law unconstitutional. The suit comes just days after Senate Republicans blocked advancement of a measure to repeal the ban. The Obama administration's lifted a ban on deportations to Haiti. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says it expects to resume deporting Haitian immigrants next month, the one-year anniversary of the earthquake that killed over 300,000 people. Human rights groups have criticized the move amidst a cholera outbreak, election-related violence, and the ongoing devastation from the earthquake. In a statement, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and Alternative Chance called the move unconscionable, adding, quote, "The situation in Haiti has not improved and may be even worse now than when the deportations were halted in the weeks after the earthquake." New York has become the first U.S. state to impose a partial moratorium on the drilling process known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Outgoing Governor David Patterson has issued an executive order barring fracking until next July. A grassroots campaign pushed for a moratorium over concerns drilling could contaminate the water supplies of New York City and other areas. But Patterson's order only applies to horizontal wells, not vertical wells, which have been linked to contamination in Pennsylvania and are still undergoing environmental review. On Monday, opponents of fracking held a rally outside the New York State Senate. The actor and director, Mark Ruffalo, celebrated the moratorium, but urged anti-drilling activists to continue their struggle.
We are the first state in the nation, the first nation in the world to stand up against the dangers of hydrofracking. And I think it's very important that you people understand that you did this. The system does work. Millions of dollars came in against us and the hard work that we've been doing, and we still beat it. Okay? I don't care how anyone characterizes this. We won, but it's the first game in the playoffs, all right? And we still got plenty of games ahead of us.
Backers of low-power FM community radio stations protested outside the National Association of Broadcasters, or NAB, on Monday to call for the passage of the Local Community Radio Act before the end of the year. The bill has already been approved in the House, but secret holds have been put on the bill in the Senate. On Monday, members of the Prometheus Radio Project accused Gordon Smith, the head of the National Association of Broadcasters, of orchestrating the secret holds. As part of the demonstration, protesters hula-hooped and juggled outside the NAB offices, chanting, "Stop making us jump through hoops." Speaking at the rally was Veronica Dorsey of the group United Workers.
"We are here because we are supporting expanding community radio to every city and every town across the United States of America. The big broadcasters of the National Association of Broadcasters and their Senate friends have blocked the Local Community Radio Act. So to the National Association of Broadcasters, stop making community radio jump through hoops.
Five peace activists have been found guilty for an anti-nuclear plowshares action at a naval base in Washington state in November 2009. The activists cut a hole in a fence to access the Kitsap Bangor base. As they walked onto the grounds of the base, they left a trail of blood and hammered on the roadway. They also hammered on the fences and scattered sunflower seeds throughout the base. The base is used to service Trident nuclear missiles carried by U.S. submarines. Two of the defendants, a nun and a priest, are over 80 years old. Sentencing will be held in March. Kuwait's cracking down on the satellite network Al Jazeera for its coverage of a police assault on an opposition gathering. Al Jazeera says Kuwaiti authorities closed its office and withdrew its accreditation after the network aired footage of police officers beating opposition activists. Kuwait says Al Jazeera was censored for interference in the country's internal affairs. The Australian government's reportedly broken with the views of the U.S. and its allies on Iran's nuclear program. U.S. cables released by WikiLeaks show Australian intelligence agencies see Iran's nuclear program as a, quote, deterrent in the face of threatened military attack by Israel and the United States. The cables also show Australian officials have raised concerns about the likelihood of a unilateral military strike on Iran and have rejected labeling Iran as a rogue state. Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele has announced plans to seek a second term. Four candidates have already announced plans to replace Steele as the Republican Party head. And the veteran U.S. diplomat Richard Holbrooke has died at the age of 69. Holbrooke served under four Democratic administrations dating back to President Lyndon Johnson. In a statement, President Obama praised Holbrooke as, quote, a true giant of American foreign policy who will be remembered for his tireless diplomacy, love of country, and pursuit of peace. Widely respected in Washington and corporate media circles, Holbrooke is well known for brokering the 1995 Dayton Peace Accords that ended the war in Bosnia. But he's also come under criticism elsewhere for implementing and backing U.S. policies that have killed thousands of civilians. As Assistant Secretary of State in the Carter administration, Holbrooke oversaw weapons shipments to the Indonesian military as it killed a third of East Timor's population. In 1980, he played a key role in the Carter administration's support for a South Korean military crackdown on a pro-democracy uprising in the city of Gwangju that killed hundreds. During the 90s, Richard Holbrooke was seen as one of the key figures in the dismantling of Yugoslavia. He was also a prominent Democratic backer of the Bush administration's decision to attack Iraq in 2003. Richard Holbrooke served as President Obama's chief envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan until his death. According to The Washington Post, family members say Richard Holbrooke's final words said to his Pakistani surgeon were, quote, you've got to stop this war in Afghanistan. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Virginia ruled Monday that a key provision of President Obama's health care law is unconstitutional. Judge Henry Hudson in Richmond said the law's requirement that most Americans buy health insurance or face penalties exceeds the regulatory authority granted to Congress under the Common Clause. In a 42-page opinion, Judge Hudson wrote, at its core, this dispute is not simply about regulating the business of insurance or crafting a scheme of universal health insurance coverage. It's about an individual's right to choose to participate. This is the third time a federal court has ruled on the constitutionality of the health care law, but the first time it's been ruled unconstitutional. There are some two dozen lawsuits challenging the health care law around the country. The debate over the law is expected to end up before the Supreme Court. According to The New York Times, the rulings related to the legislation have split along political lines. The Times writes, quote, thus far, judges appointed by Republican presidents have ruled consistently against the Obama administration, while Democratic appointees have found for it. The judge in the Virginia case, Judge Hudson, was appointed by President George W. Bush. Hudson's the part owner of Campaign Solutions, a Republican consulting firm that's worked to oppose health care reform. Federal disclosures show he's earned up to $108,000 in dividends from his holdings in the firm since 2003. At the White House, Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told reporters he was confident of the law's constitutionality.
We're confident that it is constitutional, and quite frankly, of the three courts that have rendered decisions on this question, two have ruled in our favor. The Department of Justice obviously is going to have to make some decisions about appealing this particular case. My sense is that that appeal decision is something they'll likely make.
For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by John Walker, a writer and policy analyst for the website Fire Dog Lake. John Walker, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what the judge ruled.
Well, the judge ruled that it was exceeding the powers of Congress, using the Commerce Clause, to force individuals to buy a service from a private entity. And so he only struck down the individual mandate provision in the law, which requires everyone who doesn't have insurance to purchase insurance from a private company.
And talk about the significance of this. By the way, how does it compare to, for example, when you buy a car, you have to have auto insurance?
Well, for one thing, that is a state law. So that actually doesn't have to do with the federal constitution. That's a state-by-state law. And the other thing is, you don't have to own a car. You know, nothing sort of forcing you to be the owner and driver of a car, as opposed to just living, which is the only requirement for you to be forced to buy insurance in the individual mandate. There is no way out of it. You know, this would apply to everyone. So it's sort of a taxation through a private entity, and that is what he said was an overstep of the Commerce Clause in the current powers of the Constitution.
And so—
And the effect it would have on the health care— Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
The effect it would have on the health care bill, because he only struck down the individual mandate provision, there's a debate about how big people think that is. I always considered that individual mandate to be so much less than the actual cost of the health insurance that the impact I thought it would have was rather minor.
So talk about the ways, if this were, if the Supreme Court agreed, health care reform legislation could remain intact. How would it have to change?
As far as Judge Hutchins' ruling, since he only struck down the individual mandate position, provision, everything else would remain in place, all the regulations, all the subsidies, all the expansion of Medicaid, all those remain in place. People would—many experts think you need something to cause people to buy insurance before they get sick. The loss of an individual mandate itself is actually not all that critical. There are other ways to achieve a similar function. You could have everyone automatically enrolled in some public program. You know, Medicare currently is constitutional, obviously. You could tax people, give them some basic health care, have them then get the option to buy private insurance if they wanted to. You could provide an open enrollment period for the insurance companies, so you could only buy insurance without paying higher rates at a certain time each year to prevent people from only signing up when they get sick. You could put in place some kind of back payment system or back premium payment system, where if you go to sign up for insurance and you'd previously been uninsured, you have to pay the insurance company, you know, what's equal to 6 months of insurance premiums before they start covering you. So there's a bunch of walkarounds. If this is all that's ever dropped because it's unconstitutional, you should easily, if Congress is willing to, and that's a big political question, find a solution that would still make the bill work.
What if a public option had been part of this legislation that was passed, John Walker?
I think it would be very hard for him to reach this ruling, because he said it was unconstitutional for the government to tell individuals they had to buy from a private entity. With a public option in there, the government would be actually saying you have to buy this item of the government, or face a penalty. So I believe with the public option in there, it would have been constitutional. And you could even redesign the entire system with a public option so that instead of it being a fee for not having insurance, it's a general tax, provided the public option with the ability to then opt out for private insurance. Basically in the same way we run Medicaid right now. You know, you can either get Medicaid, or you can opt out into the private exchange, which is Medicaid Advantage.
I'm looking at the New York Times, which is talking about the Virginia Attorney General Kenneth Cuccinelli, who filed the lawsuit minutes after President Obama signed the law on March 23rd and has been discussing the case on cable television ever since. The Times writes, by late afternoon Monday, he'd already posted campaign fundraising advertisements online that cited his victory.
This has become a real political hot potato. The interesting thing is, many Republicans in the past have signed on to the individual mandate. Mitt Romney obviously had an individual mandate in his health care bill in Massachusetts. There was the Wyden-Bennett plan, which was a health care plan proposed a few years back, had, about seven Republican co-sponsors in the Senate. There was the alternative to the Clinton health care plan back in the 90s. Put forward by Republicans that also had an individual mandate in it. So the Republicans only really found their deep-seated opposition to it when it became Obama's individual mandate, and only started thinking it was unconstitutional when it was part of the Democrats' health care bill. So this entire time, this has been quite politicized. And it's no surprise to me that the two judges that found in favor of it were Democratic appointees. And this judge, Hudson, who is known to be a very conservative judge, appointed by Republicans, worked to advance Republican campaigns before getting on the bench, opposed it.
Well, let's talk about—
Or declared it unconstitutional.
How the judge may benefit in various ways, including financial. The original piece appearing at Gawker.com, Henry Hudson, the federal judge in Virginia who just ruled on the health care reform bill, calling it unconstitutional, owns between $15,000 and $50,000 in a GOP political consulting firm that's worked against health care reform. His company, Campaign Solutions, a Republican consulting firm that worked this election cycle for John Boehner, John McCain, Sarah Palin, and others. Can you talk more about this, John Walker?
He did own this company before getting on the bench, and he's continued to own it ever since. Some people would try to make the connection that he should have recused himself because his company did work with the attorney general on his campaign. Basically, it just shows that he's a Republican operative and a Republican partisan.
And his firm worked against
Yes, and his company worked against it.
And worked with, the incoming Speaker of the House, John Boehner.
He's a Republican partisan that got put on the bench. This is sort of, sadly, what's been happening to our judicial system all over the place. Clarence Thomas's wife worked for a group that directly benefited from the Citizens United decision. This is unfortunately happening all over.
Well, John Walker, I want to thank you for being with us. That piece in Gawker also refers to the Huffington Post's earlier reportage on this, as well as Judicial Watch. John Walker is a writer and policy analyst for the website Fire Dog Lake. Thanks for being with us today on this cold day. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Light in my window, free life, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate voted overwhelmingly Monday to move President Obama's controversial tax deal with Republicans to a final vote today. The bill passed by a vote of 83 to 15. Last week, Obama agreed to extend the Bush-era tax cut for the wealthiest Americans and reduce the estate tax in return for a 13-month extension of jobless benefits and a handful of tax credits for low- and moderate-income Americans. According to the New York Times, at least a quarter of the tax savings under the deal will go to the wealthiest 1% of the population. The only group that will see its taxes increase are the nation's lowest-paid workers. The Senate will vote on final passage of the legislation today. On Monday, President Obama spoke to reporters at the White House and praised the bipartisan support of the bill.
I am pleased to announce at this hour the United States Senate is moving forward on a package of tax cuts that has strong bipartisan support. And this proves that both parties can, in fact, work together to grow our economy and look out for the American people. I recognize that folks on both sides of the political spectrum are unhappy with certain parts of the package, and I understand those concerns. I share some of them. But that's the nature of compromise, sacrificing something that each of us cares about to move forward on what matters to all of us. Right now, that's growing the economy and creating jobs. And nearly every economist agrees that that is what this package will do.
House Democratic leaders hope to take up the Senate bill later this week and allow an amendment that would rewrite the estate tax language to increase the rate from 35% to 45% and lower the amount of wealth exempted from $5 million to $3.5 million. For more, we're joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist David K. Johnston. He's a columnist for Tax Analysts, a professor at Syracuse University, former reporter for The New York Times. His most recent book is called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Sorry you couldn't be in a TV studio in Rochester, but I understand it's so cold they couldn't move the satellite. So thanks for joining us.
Years on the satellite dish.
Well, David K. Johnston, talk about the legislation that the Senate is poised to pass today.
Well, you certainly cannot accuse the Republicans of leaving any money on the table. They got an extraordinarily good deal that raises, I think, basic questions about the negotiating skills of the president. The bottom roughly 45 million families in America, or households in America, and there are a little over 100 million households, they're going to actually see their taxes go up. And that's because President Obama is making work pay credit, $400 per person, $200 for a couple, and you got it even if you were retired or disabled, is going to go away. And it's going to be replaced by this temporary 2% reduction in the payroll tax, the Social Security tax. Well, for about 45 million households who make less than $20,000 a year, this is a tax increase of $150 to $200 each. So it certainly seems to me it's reasonable going forward, given how the Republicans have emphasized they will never raise taxes on anyone, and they're the party of tax cuts, that the Republicans have now become the party of tax increases on the poor. At the top end, if you're a two-income couple and you make a little over $100,000 each, so you pay the maximum Social Security tax, you didn't get Obama's making work pay credit. You were regarded as too well off. But that Social Security payroll tax decrease is going to mean about a $4,200 tax cut for you. So clearly we can see that the scheme of this is the better off you are, the more help you get from the government, the worse off you are, your taxes go up.
You wrote a piece saying that President Obama should call their bluff. What do you think of what President Obama has done?
Well, he certainly didn't call their bluff. Remember that the Republicans are the minority party even in January. They cannot pass any legislation unless the Democrats go along with them. And there's an important issue to the plutocrats at the very top of the Republican Party who've been financing a lot of these policies through the people they donate to and put in office. And that's the estate tax. If nothing was done, the estate tax was going to go back to a $1 million exemption and a 55% rate. That's far more troubling to you if you're a billionaire or a centimillionaire than a marginal change in your tax rate. So I think what the president should have done was hung tough, said to the Republicans he would veto anything that didn't meet his standards. If he'd adjusted the increase, the area where taxes would go up on income to $1 million from $250,000, that wouldn't have been a big deal. And by the way, very important point the news media keeps missing, that $250,000 was not income, it was taxable income, which is much smaller than total income.
We're talking to David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. David, you've also written about how the media covers this issue. Explain what isn't explained.
Well, it's covered mostly through talking points. In fact, I have a piece in Nieman Reports from Harvard University out today about how much that I'm reading of economic news that is just nonsense. I mean, it accurately quotes what politicians are saying, but it's economic nonsense because the reporters writing about it are very best papers at the Washington Post, at the New York Times, at the Wall Street Journal, often do not know what it is that they're writing about. And this I find to be one of the most troubling aspects of this, because after all, as the great conservative commentator Edmund Burke wrote in 1793, the revenue of the state is the state. Taxes are the system by which we distribute the burden of being able to live in a free society. And to not understand how they work, it results in all sorts of manipulations by people who make ridiculous claims about the tax system.
I want to play some of what Congressmember Paul Ryan had to say about tax cuts. He's a Wisconsin Republican and the incoming chair of the House Budget Committee. He was speaking on Fox News Sunday. He said the only tax reform he would pursue if the current bill doesn't pass is across-the-board lower rates.
What we're going to do is what the Democrats didn't do. We're going to cut spending. I mean, I find it sort of interesting that after this massive spending spree that took place over the last 2 years, the creation of two new health care entitlements, now there's concern about deficits when they have a chance of raising taxes. We're not interested in raising taxes. $544 billion of that package you're talking about are simply keeping taxes where they are. The other $313 billion of this package is some of the spending stuff that you're talking about. So we don't want to see spending. We're going to come out of the gates going after spending, Chris, spending cuts, spending controls, reforms to the structure of spending. And if we get to the point of doing tax reform, which I think is an important way to go, we should go with broader base, lower rates for economic growth. Erskine Bowles, Alice Rivlin, centrist Democrats agree with that premise. And I would love to see the chance of getting a compromise so we can have good pro-growth tax reform, which is not tax increases, but lowering tax rates so we can have economic growth in America.
I got a minute.
That's Wisconsin Republican Congressmember Paul Ryan. David K. Johnston, your response.
Well, here's the fundamental problem with what he's saying. What matters is what you spend the taxes on. I have shown that you can raise taxes and actually have more money in your pocket if the government can buy something for you more efficiently. You want to get rid of the deficits. And by the way, President Obama's first budget had a smaller deficit than George Bush's last budget. If you want to get rid of the deficit and have a balanced budget, there's the number one way to do that is universal health care that gets the business of health care off the backs of small business owners so they're not diverted from running their businesses and brings down costs. The Republicans are insistent that health care should be a profit-making business, not a public service. That it is the equivalent, in their view, of requiring kindergarten teachers to do cost accounting when they hand out crayons to the children. That's inefficient and very expensive. The issue is not rates. It is what do we spend the money on and what do we subsidize? There's something called the Shelf Project done by a number of professors who've dug into the tax code very deeply, and they've shown that without raising rates, government could bring in $1 trillion a year. That's as much as the income tax brought in 2008, $1 trillion by simply taking away loopholes for corporations.
How do the Republicans, well, and the Democrats who are supporting this, overwhelming support now in the Senate, explain the deficit? I mean, when you're talking about how much money are we talking about, this will increase the deficit by $826 billion over the next decade.
Well, I think it will be very interesting, Amy, to watch Fox News. I have a number of times in my column pointed out polls they commissioned but then did not talk about on the air because they didn't fit the ideology that Fox News is promoting. I suspect you'll hear a lot less about the deficit, and if you do, it will now be Obama's deficit, not the deficit of George Bush, George H.W. Bush, and Ronald Reagan, who ran up three-quarters of our federal debt. but Obama's deficit. And what the president's given away is a trend line that would have been a shrinking federal deficit going into the future. How this will play out in 2 years will be very interesting to watch.
Hey, Johnston, when we're watching television, tell us what are the bullet points to watch for of the misrepresentations or outright lies that the journalists continually reiterate when talking about this?
Well, failing to report that this is a tax increase on the bottom roughly 45 million households in America, close to 150 million people. That's number one. This is a tax increase for those people. Secondly, that the more money you make, the bigger your tax cut under the Republican plan. Thirdly, that the estate tax reductions to 35% and a $5 million or for a married couple, $10 million exemption involve money in many cases that has never been taxed. When very wealthy people die, the reason they're wealthy is they've reported legally less income than they made on an economic basis. So they have lots of money that was never taxed, and now it will never be taxed up to $5 or $10 million because of these changes. And those are key things that I would watch for. The other one is we're going to cut spending. Well, there are only four big areas of federal government spending. Interest, which is low right now because interest rates are low. That'll go back up. The military, the Republicans are not exactly known for wanting to restrain military spending. Medicare, Medicaid, that is government-provided health care for the elderly, the disabled, and the poor, and then Social Security, which people paid into and expect to collect in their old age. So what are they going to cut? Are they going to cut food safety inspection, which is a tiny, tiny fraction of a penny, and worse in a situation in which foodborne illness occurs in this country at something like, I think it's 20 times the rate in France and 7 times the rate in England? Are we going to further take away education from poor children? Are we going to raise the cost of a higher education, which reduces the value of the most valuable asset we have, young minds that we should be training and developing so we have a prosperous future?
David K. Johnston, you wrote recently, newly released government income data shows average wages and total wages declined for all income brackets last year, except at the very top, where they leaped dramatically. And you say that the average American income in the highest income bracket, those earning more than $50 million a year, increased fivefold to an average.
No, that, Amy, let me stop you. That comes from Social Security, from payroll data. It was erroneous data. Two people trying to mess up the government's records filed false statements, and I hope the government's going to go prosecute them for this. The government's revised the numbers. The fact is there were 74 workers who made over $50 million. And the important measures are this. In 2009, of everybody who had a job in 2008, 1 in 34 went all of 2009 without earning a dollar. The median wage in 2009 was smaller than it was in the year 2000, and the average wage compared to 2000 was only up less than 1%. And that's only because of the growth at the top. All of the people who are making six, seven, eight, nine-figure salaries from their work. And remember, people like hedge fund managers aren't counted in that because they get to live tax-free currently under our law. You can make $1 billion a year as a hedge fund manager and legally pay no income taxes, thanks to Congress.
I want to play for you a clip of what one billionaire had to say about this, Warren Buffett.
But I think that people at the high end, people like myself, should be paying a lot more in taxes. We have it better than we've ever had it.
They say you have to keep those tax cuts, even on the very wealthy, because that is what energizes business and capitalism.
The rich are always going to say that, you know, just give us more money and we'll go out and spend more, and then it'll all trickle down to the rest of you. But that has not worked the last 10 years, and I hope the American public is catching on.
That's Warren Buffett being interviewed by ABC's Christiane Amanpour, David K. Johnston. How many billionaires are lobbying for what has happened, or how many billionaires agree with what Warren Buffett has to say?
Well, there's actually a substantial number of very wealthy people in America who do not agree with these policies, who believe that they should be paying higher taxes, and who said so. Buffett is probably at the far end of that. And I'm somebody who's been very, very critical of Buffett for the huge advantages he takes of the tax system in his efforts to pocket taxes that people are forced to pay to some of his companies because they're monopolies. But there is significant disagreement among the wealthiest in this country. What you have is a small segment of people, the Koch brothers, the Mars family, the family that owns Coors Beer or used to own Coors Beer, that group of people who've been funding their ideological belief. And basically, they want the benefits of being in America without sharing the burdens and without following the ancient conservative principle, 2,500 years old. And remember that most of them who oppose these policies say they're conservatives, that the greater the gain you manage to achieve, the greater the share of your income you should pay so that your society will continue.
Finally, David K. Johnston, can you talk about the significance of the long-term capital gains and dividend tax rates remaining at 15% next year?
Well, in theory, the theory is that these low rates encourage investment. The problem is two things. One, a great deal of this investment is going overseas because you can hire people in China for a week for what they would cost you in America for an hour, which is driving down the wages of Americans in many occupations, not just those that are going overseas. But secondly, and here's the problem that's getting no public debate, Amy, if you lower the tax rate and allow people to withdraw capital from their businesses through dividends to 15%, there are a lot of people who are going to say, be nice to have a third mansion or a second jet if they're further up the feeding chain or a $100 million oil painting. And when you withdraw from the business, you're destroying jobs. We used to have high taxes on business, and businesses complained about it, but the business owners were forced by that to reinvest in the business and create jobs. Low taxes encourage withdrawal from business, which means destroying jobs and putting money into unproductive uses like buying nice art to hang in your home.
Your response to the Illinois Democratic Senator, Dick Durbin, one of the most powerful in the Senate, who said he understands opposition to the bill from liberal Democrats outraged over the substantial relief given the wealthy in estate tax provisions. He said, in the spirit of the season, it does say, God bless Tiny Tim and Donald Trump.
Yes, well, I think Tiny Tim probably is going to go hungry Christmas Eve under this bill compared to Mr. Trump, who will be able to continue flying around in his personal Boeing 727 jet.
David K. Johnston, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, columnist for Tax Analysts, professor at Syracuse University. His most recent book, called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He's a former reporter for The New York Times. David, stay warm up there.
Maybe I will.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the largest prison strike in U.S. history. Stay with us. See you. Is the Time by Elaine Brown, who is our next guest. That's right. At least four prisons in Georgia remain in lockdown 5 days after prisoners went on strike in protest of poor living and working conditions. Using cell phones purchased from the guards, the prisoners were able to coordinate the protests across Georgia. On Monday, Georgia officials confirmed four prisons are still in lockdown: Hays State Prison, Tryon, Macon State Prison in Oglethorpe, Telfair State Prison in Helena, and Smith State Prison in Glenville. There have also been reports of prisoners going on strike in several other facilities. The prisoners say they'll continue refusing to leave their cells or perform their jobs until they receive better medical care and nutrition, more educational opportunities, payment for the work they do in the prisons. In addition, they're demanding just parole decisions, an end to cruel and unusual punishments, and better access to their families. Well, joining us now is a longtime prison activist, Elaine Brown. She's a member of the newly formed group Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoners' Rights. She's the former chair of the Black Panther Party. She's joining us from Berkeley, California. Up until recently, she lived in Atlanta, Georgia. Elaine Brown, it's being called the biggest prison strike in U.S. history. Explain what's happening.
These men created what is effectively a spontaneous decision by networking with each other and saying, you know, we're tired of all of the abuse we've been suffering here, as so many other prisoners before them have said. We're going to do something, but the something we're going to do is not to try to initiate a violent response or initiate violence, but to simply say we will not work until we're paid and the other demands and petitions that they have made, as you've outlined. And they made a decision that that would be on December 9th. I have no idea why they picked that date and how they ended up getting perhaps 10 prisons involved. But at that point, of course, the guards and the administration became aware of their intention. And so when they locked down on the night of the 8th, their decision was to not get up, and they didn't. But the prison pretends, and the administration has pretended, that they locked the men down. But they're talking about four prisons, and there were probably 10 in the initial one-day strike, as it was slated to be. They have refused. We're in day 6, and they are still holding out and saying they will not come out and work unless they can sit down at the table and begin to get their demands and their met and their issues dealt with.
Elaine Brown, your son is in the Macon State Prison. He is there still on lockdown there?
Not only is he on lockdown, but he's in the hole right now because from almost day one or so, I was informed that he was taken off to the hole, deemed some sort of leader. Just for the sake of the record, because somebody asked, said, I understand Elaine Brown doesn't have a son. Well, I didn't give birth to this boy. I have known him for 15 years, and I have been with him for that long since he was incarcerated and put into an adult facility at 14 years old, and he's done 14 years now. And so he is my son for all, in all meaningful ways.
Can you describe the conditions in the Georgia State Prison System, Elaine Brown?
Well, I'm sure they're not very much different from other prisons. I mean, or as the men would say, the chain gang or the camp they're in. You know, you have overcrowded conditions. There is no activity other than the work tasks that they're assigned to do. In other words, there's no real educational opportunities. There's no exercise. There's nothing else. The food is bad. They have poor nutrition. They have overcrowded cells. A lot of the day-to-day thing, I think the most important part is that, as it was outlined many years ago in the Stanford study conducted by Dr. Phil Zimbardo, one of the most important things is that the constant violence being perpetrated against them by guards who, with their own idle time, look to try and instigate an incident here or there. So there's a lot of screaming, hollering, aggressive behaviors that go on. And so there's always some incident, jumping off, as it were, and so forth and so on. It's just a life of idleness and violence and a lack of any basic human condition.
Talk about what they do in their work. I mean, among the conditions, the demands of the prisoners are a living wage for work, talking about being a violation of the 13th Amendment of the Constitution that prohibits slavery and voluntary servitude. What are the work conditions? What are they paid? Are they paid? What are they—
No, in Georgia, they're not even paid. They're not paid one dime in the state of Georgia. I mean, the State Department of Corrections would like to say they have some workers that are paid. There are probably some people doing life without parole who work at the governor's mansion, maybe 15 of them who might be getting some money. But the prisoners in the state of Georgia are paid nothing at all. Now, that's not to say that the prisoners in other states are being paid. They're mostly being paid a dollar a day to 50 cents an hour. That would probably be the maximum. So they're not exactly being paid enough money to accumulate anything over the years of their incarceration and maybe come out of the prison with more than the $25 check they give them upon release in the state of Georgia. So they are not paid one single dime, and they are required to clean the floors, clean the showers, do the yard work, do the dishes, cook the food, in other words, to maintain the prison itself.
I'm looking at a report out of the Black Agenda report, and it talks about how there's no educational programs available beyond GED, with the exception of a single program that trains inmates to be Baptist ministers.
That's absolutely correct. I believe that's at Phillips State Prison, and it's a school out of Louisiana. And I think there are about 20 people even enrolled in that program. So it's almost pointless to even mention it.
Talk about how this largest prison strike in U.S. history was organized, sort of redefining the term cell phone, Elaine Brown.
Well, you know, a lot of people have been fascinated by this, and I'm glad that you made note immediately that you know, so many people said, well, these guys have contraband. Well, the greatest avenue for their obtaining these cell phones is by sales from guards. And these guards are selling these phones at exorbitant prices. I learned the other day that one guy said he paid $800 to a guard for a cell phone that's probably worth about 50 bucks. So that's the first point that has to be made, because people imagine that there's all this smuggling going on, and there is, but it's on the part of, in the main, on the part of guards that are inside of these facilities. The cell phone played a part, but the other part was that there are leaders of different factions in the prison, and they were able to sort of discuss what could they do instead of fighting among themselves. Is there anything that they could do to try to change the conditions of being just constantly bombarded with violent attacks, with, you know, idle time and so forth and so on? And they, at some point, a number of them just decided, well, we just shouldn't work. And it just it became a prairie fire. It was truly the spark that lit the prairie fire. And everybody was saying, well, I'm down with that. We're not going to get up. And each group, you know, you have blacks in various subsets, and you have Muslims, you have Mexicans and other Latinos, Hispanics, you have whites, you have Rastafarians, you have Christians. All of them, for reasons that I cannot explain how they suddenly understood how to be unified, decided, yeah, we're not working, and we're down with this, and we're not going to get up, and we're going to stay united. And across the prisons in the various sets, they called each other, sent text messages, and they all agreed to do it, and they agreed on the date, and that was December 9.
Elaine, I interviewed you a long time ago when your memoir came out, A Taste of Power, A Black Woman's Story. You're the former chair of the Black Panther Party. Can you tell us a little bit about your life and how you came to be a prison activist today?
Well, it's pretty, you know, it's sort of organic, very much like this prisoner strike. You know, we used to say in the Black Panther Party, repression breeds resistance. pardon me. I was born in the ghettos of North Philadelphia. I was raised, rather, in the ghettos of North Philadelphia. Even though I went to sort of privileged schools and so forth and so on, I was very conscious of that. When I ultimately joined the Black Panther Party at around 24 years old, I knew then that I was fully conscious that The things that I experienced in my life were part of a larger picture, and that I was a part of a group of people who were an oppressed group. From that point on, the question was liberation. The aspects of liberation and the ending of all exploitation, as we would say it, was just a matter of looking at all the various aspects of our oppression and how it played itself out. In the Black Panther Party, there was a 10-point platform and program that articulated some of the manifestations of our general oppression, talking about lack of education, as a matter of fact, not having enough food and housing. In essence, what we called for was a freedom and a right of self-determination. We recognize that our plight was not much different as Black people than other oppressed people, and we joined arms and forces with a variety of other groups like the Brown Berets, the Red Guard, the Young Lords, the Young Patriots, and so forth. And then we linked ourselves to the international struggle of people around the world for national liberation in Vietnam, throughout the continent of Africa, and in Latin America, South America. So we became internationalists, and I remain that person. So it isn't complicated to draw the line from that struggle to the struggle of the most oppressed group in America, the prisoner class. The prisoners in this country, as you know, make up the largest prisoner group in the world. America confines more people than any single country at a higher rate and the largest number. 50% of those prisoners, or nearly 50% of them, are Black men. And so we have to ask the question, how did that come to be? Either the Black men are the only people, when we consider that we Black people make up approximately 12 to 13% of the overall population, and yet almost 50% of the prison population, we have to ask the question, is this the result of some sort of genetic flaw in Black people? Are we obviously some sort of criminally minded, or is there something wrong in the scheme of things? Obviously, the latter is what I would say, and so I've committed myself to bringing people out of prison. I have a very close friend who was a member of the Black Panther Party, here in California, who has been in prison since 1969, over 41 years, Chip Fitzgerald. So I helped to organize the Committee to Free Chip Fitzgerald. These people have been buried in prison for their political beliefs, and they've been buried in prison for their poverty. There are no rich people languishing in the prisons of America. So there's a class question, there's a race question, and this is just a continuation of expressing my efforts or continuing my efforts toward the goal of the liberation of all oppressed people.
Elaine Brown, I want to thank you very much for being with us and just ask you a final question about what you expect the outcome of. It was planned as a one-day strike, December 9th, biggest strike in U.S. history in prisons. But with lockdown continuing in a number of the state prisons in Georgia, what's going to happen?
Well, this coalition that you have mentioned, the Concerned Coalition to Respect Prisoner Rights, which includes everything from the NAACP National Office and the State Office to the Nation of Islam and a number of other organizations, All of Us or None, so forth. Across the country, we've been talking in conference calls over the last 2 days. We are to have a meeting at this point with either the commissioner or deputy commissioner of the Department of Corrections. We plan on imploring them to first stop instigating the situation and trying to escalate it to a violent confrontation, which is what they are doing by prodding men with everything, turning off the heat, beating people in their, forcing them out of their cells, turning off the hot water, destroying and trashing people's property, not feeding them, and so forth and so on, all kinds of tactics to instigate a violent response. So our first goal is to make sure this does not become Attica, although it is not like Attica because the prisoners have not taken hostages or anything of this sort. They're simply not leaving their cells.
Elaine Brown, we're going to have to leave it there.
And then the next step—
But I thank you very much for being
All
with
right,
us.
Thank you.
Longtime prison activist, former chair of the Black Panther Party. Thank you so much. We'll continue to follow the Georgia strike. That does it for our show. First, we want to wish our best wishes and bon voyage to Democracy Now! Producer Anjali Kamat. She's spending the next year traveling the world doing on-the-ground reports for us at Democracy Now! From the Middle East to Southeast Asia. Anjali, we wish you the very best. We will all miss you here in New York, but look forward to all your reports. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, Fidel Caduceo, Aramonte, and Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Masood, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.